It's Berlin Briefing time in a historic week here in Europe. The NATO alliance has agreed to a huge increase in spending on defence to 5% of GDP. That's hundreds of billions of extra spending in the hope of scaring off Vladimir Putin on the one hand and keeping Donald Trump on side on the other hand. Even calling him daddy, as we found out. Today we're going to focus on the Trump side of the picture and just how much he is now in fact driving the political agenda here in Berlin and Europe more widely. We're a team effort on this today with Michaela Kufner and Nina Haser with me here in Berlin, and Terry Schultz is joining us from Brussels. So Terry, you were at that NATO summit in The Hague, and you've been to so many NATO summits before, but not that many where the word daddy was bandied around like this. Like, how was it for you?
I said the same thing, that this is, we should Google if a Secretary General has ever said daddy publicly ever. So
that we have to ask ChatGPT now, Terry.
I'm sure we'll talk about the daddy part later. Let me do the serious stuff first. This was an historic summit for NATO. And, you know, they say that every time. And as you said, I've been to plenty, and it's always historic when you talk to NATO. There's always perfect unity. But this time, actually, this increase in defense spending up to 5% of GDP, if they do it, is really historic. Simply agreeing to do it is a really big deal, because a lot of them, as you know, aren't even spending 2% of their GDP on their defense now. And they're saying within the next 10 years, they're going to then, in some cases, more than double it. Now, this was primarily driven by Trump, even though Secretary General Rutte says, oh no, you know, we would have had to do this anyway. Even on the campaign trail, he was saying, and he just pulled this number out of a hat, I think, you know, NATO members need to spend 5% of their GDP in order to be equivalent with the United States, which does not spend 5% of its GDP on defense. But, you know, Trump has always been haranguing the allies, fairly enough, to spend more. And agreeing to do that yesterday at least puts them on the spot. They've admitted that they haven't pulled their own weight inside NATO. They've admitted that they haven't done enough to keep themselves safe should they have to do so. And agreeing with a couple of exclusions like Spain and Slovakia that they're going to do it still does put it on a completely different trajectory than it was before the summit agreement.
Yeah, so, and let's just listen to one thing that Trump said, because he did this press conference and he was asked at one point, you know, what's your attitude to Article 5? You know, so this kind of cardinal bit of NATO's foundation, saying that an attack on one is an attack on all. And we heard quite a different Trump from what we've heard before. So let's just listen to what he said.
And when I was around that table, it was a nice group of people, many of whom I knew from previous. When I saw the passion they had for the country, almost everyone, and you probably have the tapes, it was very public, but almost every one of them said, thank God for the United States. Without the United States, they couldn't really have NATO. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. It will in the future, because now they're paying much more money, but it wouldn't work. It was great. And I left here differently. I left here saying that these people really love their countries. It's not a ripoff. And we're here to help them protect their country.
So, Terry, I mean, we know the mindset of Donald Trump, you know, he's very sort of nation first. It sounds like for the first time, he's trying to indicate that he's started to kind of gel with the idea of NATO and that he started to feel some kind of ownership about it now.
Absolutely. It was honestly shocking to hear him, of all people, talk like that. It was as if he understood for the first time why European leaders are worried, why they need to band together, why they need the United States. No one could believe it. I think that Europe must have been, you know, just baffled in a good way at how this could have happened, because you never hear him talk like that. It wasn't public, so he seemed to think that we all heard those speeches, and we didn't, but of course we've heard them before. You know,
But what are you hearing from people who were in the room? Like, was it as kowtowing as he makes it sound?
Well, I think in this case, he was talking about their love for their own countries and explaining why they already, in some cases, several countries already spend 5% of their GDP. I think the kowtowing came in other ways. Yes, all of them thank him. And this was a tacit agreement, Richard, I can tell you, because this was expressed behind the scenes, that they had all basically agreed amongst themselves that they were going to say thanks, Mr. Trump, as many times as it took until he was happy with them. They had basically sold this summit to him in advance as, we're going to go to 5% as you wanted. We're going to give you credit for it. Just please, please, please come. Don't screw it up. don't pull Article 5, don't pull some of, you know, the U.S.'s key resources, and we'll say this is all thanks to you.
Yeah, so let's get the Germany side of this. Michaela, relief here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, clearly we've seen not just Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, but also Friedrich Merz try and charm Donald Trump. And charming people really isn't his normal attitude to politics and to getting stuff done.
So Merz is usually kind of a, give us that discrepancy.
He's a business type. I mean, you can tell that they speak the same kind of language in wanting to do a deal and getting stuff done. But he and I think it's always interesting to make a comparison to the previous government. He will not be tempted to make a principled statement. I mean, you know, in the debriefing we got when he came back from the US, he was asked many times, why did he sit there in silence and just let Trump say this and that and everything? And the resounding sense that we got is that they decided it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
It just causes so much trouble that you then have to go into. So clearly that strategy is working out for NATO as well.
Yeah. Can I just throw in, just for the sake of cross-promotion, that we did an entire episode on how did Merz deal with Donald Trump? So if you want to go back, check it out.
So let's listen to what Merz said after the NATO summit himself, because he was kind of talking about this issue about, like, are we doing this just to keep Trump happy or is it beyond that? So let's listen to what he said.
Diese großen Investitionen.
These large investments are not something we do in order to do anyone a favor, but we're doing these investments because we want to spend it, because we have to spend it in the interest of our own safety. We're doing this in our own interest.
So, Nina, I mean, the suggestion there is that, it's not all about Trump. It's also basically about Putin, So we're doing this to keep Europe safe from Vladimir Putin. But isn't there a sense of, like, kind of, we've been here before, right? I mean, so just after Putin invaded Ukraine, Olaf Scholz, so Merz's predecessor, made this famous speech where he talked about a Zeitenwende, so this, like, kind of turning point in German history, where he was going to pour loads of money into defense. So, what happened to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's astonishing the speed at which this is developing and how Germany is trying to really push through some key policies following Russia's attack against Ukraine. This was 3 years ago now, and at the time, Olaf Scholz announced the turning point and then launched a special defense fund of 100 billion euros, which at the time, everybody said, wow, this is massive. But of course, it was not an annual 100 billion. It was a one-off fund, and this is going to run out in 2028, right? So now, of course, the Germans are faced with this idea, oh no, we thought it was going to somehow end at some point, and we could modernize our army sort of step by step. But no, I think in many ways, the NATO summit in The Hague was the true Zeitenwende. It was the true turning point. And I think that many people here in Europe, including in Berlin, including in German society, still haven't grasped the extent to which this is going to change policies. This is going to affect our societies. This is going to have an effect that we will see over the next coming years. This will have an effect on the next couple of generations because, of course, we're going to end up spending up to 170 billion euros per year on defence.
Yeah. So, and I mean, Terry, just to quickly get your angle on this, because, of course, you cover NATO all the time. You covered NATO for years. What was the NATO perspective on the Zeitenwende? Back at HQ, did people think that Germany did get serious at that moment, or it's taken all of this to get Germany to a more serious point?
I think people did think Germany had gotten serious. And like with Trump, when he says anything nice, Germany volunteering to spend money that they thought it should have been spending already was very welcome, and everybody wanted to believe it. You know, for years, Germany said, oh, our neighbors don't want to see us spend 2% of our GDP, the pledge 2014. They said it over and over, even in off-the-record briefings, and every single ally said, try us, Germany. I think we'll be okay. So they definitely wanted Germany to be spending that money, because Germany wasn't just not spending the money. Its state of troop readiness and equipment and stockpiles were just in a really sorry state. You know,
and they still are. They still are, Terry. Yeah.
It's fat. Yeah, it takes a really long time. But, you know, remember, we all remember them, you know, hearing about German soldiers practicing on the battlefield with broomsticks and going boom, boom, because they didn't have guns to practice with. So that doesn't really inspire, fear in your enemy. But back to the point about the 5%, just one more thing to help our audience understand and also to sort of cast doubt on Mark Rutte's claim that we were always going to go to 5%. It's not just about Trump. What they had been talking about raising defense spending to the new pledge was 3%, maybe 3.5% for most of the last, let's say, 12 months. That's what we were discussing. Could they make it to 3% or could they push it up to 3.5%? It was a Rutte suggestion that they then come up with this second category of 1.5% that then gets you to 5%. So what we're really talking about is 3.5% of basic defense spending, not 5%.
And that 1.5% is pretty mushily defined. You can put, you could probably define almost anything you want to go in the 1.5%.
Bridges, trains, whatever, yeah.
Well, there's stuff that wouldn't automatically be considered a defense-related investment that they can throw in there. But, for example, Spain said, but climate change is a security risk, which, I believe it is true. You have troops out fighting.
But it's not the way to Trump's heart, is it?
They're not going to be allowed. Yeah, no, everybody's like, don't say that. So they didn't say that, and it probably wouldn't be allowed. But there are lots of things that they should do, need to do, that can be included in the 5%. And one more key point, aid to Ukraine, which some countries already were counting in their 2% of GDP, can now be counted, and you can choose whether it goes in your 1.5 or your 3.5, because this was something that the Europeans very much wanted said. They acknowledged that Ukraine's security is Europe's security. So spending on Ukraine makes Europe safer. So that was another point that the average reader of this one-page document might not see.
Irony here is that the whole thing that set off this chain of events within NATO, the attack on Ukraine by Russia, one sentence in the final statement.
Yeah.
Also, Europe wouldn't be Europe if it didn't then go on to discuss, okay, we've agreed on 5% or 3.5% plus 1.5%, but whose money are we actually going to spend? So EU leaders then, as we're recording this, are sitting down to discuss whether this shouldn't be European money or whether this really has to come out of national budgets. So it's not all as smooth sailing as it appears on that very brief statement and that very clear statement also made towards Donald Trump, who, one has to also attest, is absolutely right. Without the US, NATO would be strategic defense toast. I mean, I just want to, highlight that
absolutely.
As well. He's just right on that.
And can I just add that, I was talking about the speed. It is just unfathomable. I mean, earlier this year, Robert Habeck, essentially the chancellor candidate for this year's elections in Germany, earlier this year for the Green Party, said, I think all experts are telling us we may have to spend up to 3.5% on defense. And everybody laughed at him at the time. And this was January this year. This was really a very, very... But then two things happened. And I think these two events triggered a complete mindset change here in Europe, including in Berlin. One, J.D. Vance's speech at the Munich Security Conference, where he essentially made it clear to the Europeans, okay, we really don't share some of your core values anymore. So this threat of the US pulling out, withdrawing from, that unity of a Western alliance, that became tangible for the very first time. And then also, of course, the scene that we saw in the White House, Oval Office, where German society for the very first time saw how some of the American administration were treating the Ukrainian president, who was saying essentially we need to defend ourselves, you need to help us, and he got attacked by
and we had bank. Elections and this government, Friedrich Merz, with the help of the Greens, now has money to spend because again historic debt now, lots of cash on the table, stark contrast to the previous government.
So all of this really is the Trump effect, as you were saying earlier, Terry. But also, I thought one thing that was interesting that Friedrich Merz said in his press conference after the summit was that he thought, how would this summit have gone if Germany had not made that decision to increase its borrowing, to kind of break its old taboos about significant borrowing? And he said it would have, descended into acrimony. And
we have had Trump at summits where Germany Germany wasn't spending enough. And we'll remember that during the first Trump
term. But of course,
screaming at Merkel.
And the difference now is that Germany feels so vulnerable because this combination of Putin's war plus Trump's pressure. Yeah. So I want to pull this a bit wider than just NATO and Ukraine and that, but to look at how Germany is positioning itself vis-a-vis Trump's actions in the Iran-Israel conflict. And Merz, just before going to the NATO summit, he made a speech in the parliament here in the Bundestag. We have a clip there.
We hope today that the actions of Israel and the United States of America in recent days will permanently deter Iran from moving closer to its destructive goal. Not only Israel, but also Europe and the world as a whole are threatened by this Iranian nuclear program.
So what Merz was talking about there, these actions by Israel and the United States, was bombing Iran's nuclear program. So, Michaela, this was Merz giving at least a veiled backing to those bombing campaigns, even though, and this is important in Germany, they were at best dubious under international law. Many experts would say they were a clear violation of international law. Tell me, to talk about like how important that is.
This is absolutely striking. On Friday, the Friday before these strikes, he had his foreign minister sign a joint statement by the E3 states, so France, Britain, Germany. The EU was also signing off on that, basically calling on all sides, including the United States, to avoid absolutely anything that could escalate the situation. Now, it's safe to say that includes bombing Iran by the Americans. Come Monday, and this statement came on Tuesday, there was no more word of it. He basically aligned with the new reality that was created, and he clearly had no interest in going into the question of whether this complies with international law. I mean, you can accuse him of basically undermining the whole issue and the whole concept of international law by not referring to it and not making a statement saying where he positions the German government in relation to the question whether this was actually legal or not. Yeah. And instead, he made pleas to Iran. He kind of hopes that there will be no more escalation, but he has no interest in going into that question. And to me, it was striking being there because we saw him in real time just shake off the whole, what I would say is a standard expectation from a German government to take a moral and legal position on such a major event, as you say, that is now being hotly debated.
Yeah. And Terry, I want to come to you in a sec because Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, went even further than Merz when talking about the American and Israeli strikes on the Iranian nuclear program. Let's listen to that quickly.
The great thing is you took out the nuclear capability of Iran. This was crucial. You did it in a way which is extremely impressive. But the signal sends to the rest of the world that this president, when it comes to it, yes, he is a man of peace, but if necessary, he is willing to use strength, the enormous strength of the American military. So I think that signal to the rest of the world, this is far beyond Iran, is extremely important.
So Terry, there's Rutte very, very, I mean, aside from the class A schmoozing kind of tone of it, but he's also very, very explicitly endorsing bombing the Iranian nuclear program. Are there any kind of grumblings within NATO about a NATO Secretary General sticking his head out so far in favor of something which, you know, as we've just been hearing here, is legally so questionable?
It's not even about the legal basis of it. It's about the fact that he has no business talking about it as the NATO Secretary General. It's not NATO business. And when he opens his mouth, he should normally do so with a unified position of 32 countries behind him. And this in no way qualifies as something that he should have been talking about as NATO Secretary General. But we need to back up a second, because the reason that I think he volunteered this statement at that photo op with Donald Trump is because of this personal message that Trump leaked. In which Rutte had already written to Trump, and the first paragraph is, thanks for what you did on Iran. No American president, you know, no other American president could have done this. You know, you make us all safer. He had written this in a text messages to Donald Trump that Trump then leaked, put out publicly. And so I feel like Rutte was trying to put this in context that, oh, this is normal for me to talk about this. And so he felt like he had to do that to sort of try to tamp down there's not an uproar, you know. To be fair, we have to go back to the fact that every country said basically, Mark, you do what you got to do to keep Trump on board, keep him happy. But a NATO Secretary General would have, you know, run to the other side of the continent rather than talk about this under normal circumstances. Mm-hmm.
But can I just add, though, Terry, that, I mean, NATO is all about deterrence. Right. So they insist that they're an alliance of defense, that they don't want to attack other countries, but that they would be willing and prepared and able to do so if they were attacked as a whole. And I read Mark Rutte's statement there as, yes, he did interfere in something that NATO, strictly speaking, has no business with, as Terry just explained. But this was a message to Vladimir Putin to say, we've got the Americans on board still. And look at this president. If you escalate to a point where Donald Trump feels convinced that this can't go on any further, then he will show some strength. And I think this is part of Rutte's strategy to try and send out this message. We have to do absolutely everything to keep the US on board, also because we need them so much when it comes to defending ourselves against Russia.
It's
unquestionable, unquestionable that the credibility of American power is the credibility of NATO's power.
Absolutely.
Right. You can't separate those two things. At the same time, I don't think anybody trusts that they do have Donald Trump on board if it came to Russia.
Yeah. But all of this does kind of, it feeds into this perception that you definitely hear in the so-called global South, that for the West, you know, they kind of complain about international law when it suits them. For instance,
they pick and choose. Yeah.
When Vladimir Putin invades Ukraine, okay, mm-hmm. breach of international law, mm-hmm. unacceptable. But when it doesn't suit them, it gets kind of shunted to one side.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an accusation that the previous government in Germany was also accused with, you know, and the foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock from the Greens, traveled around the world to try and convince people to see that this is different to other conflicts because we clearly have an act of aggression by one country against a sovereign other country that is just trying to defend itself. And now we've got a situation where, you know, lawyers are debating what's happening, and the German government is essentially just saying, well, the US and Israel are saying that they have enough proof that this act was necessary for Israel and the US as an ally of Israel to defend the sovereignty of Israel. So this is up to interpretation.
Under international law, of course, you can only launch an attack if you are under immediate threat of an attack yourself. And that doesn't mean in the long term, that means basically already the finger on the button. And that's the whole concept that is now being questioned. And there is clearly a sense that there is this exceptionalism.
But you have a situation in Germany where Germany doesn't have its own intelligence. So the German government will not know whether this is true, whether Iran was about to attack Israel, whether indeed Iran had built up its capacity to a point that such a threat was imminent or not. And what I find interesting is that they're just saying, well, we believe them. So if it's true, then of course they had to do that.
And there are just such echoes of 2003 right now, because in the lead up to the Iraq war, you know, there was the same debate about the threat emanating from Iraq, the alleged threat of weapons of mass destruction and so on. But at that time, the Germans didn't go along with what the US was doing. I mean, famously, the Germans and the French were against the Iraq war in 2003. And I think this is often forgotten internationally, that Europe and the United States are not always on the same page. But Michela, so what's different between then and now? Like, why did Germany oppose the Iraq war now? And it's kind of just quietly going along with what's been happening with respect to Iran.
Just two sentences on the circumstances, because some of our listeners and viewers might have been born in 2003. Actually, back then, we all know that the accusation that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq turned out to be false. And back then. There was a presentation also in the United Nations where the United States alleged that there were chemical weapons hidden by Saddam Hussein. And that was the whole reasoning why the US went into Iraq. And we saw the German government, led by the Social Democrats, they said they were not simply not convinced. And historically significant, it was the Green Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer, who stood up at the Munich Security Conference, said, sorry, I'm not convinced. And standing up to the United States and Germany was at least as dependent on NATO as it is right now, in the absence, of course, of an active conflict here in Europe, that was quite something. Yeah. That was pretty shocking.
But that was the huge difference, yeah? There was not an active threat perceived from Putin at that point.
No, and quite the contrary, Putin was still seen as someone who could be a potential partner in the future. Now, those times, that's history.
Terry?
History, but being that I was born so long before 2000...
as we all were.
That I was actually there at the United Nations. I was covering the State Department at that time, so I was covering Colin Powell as he was the one appointed to go around and try to force the Allies to come on board. Wolfgang Ischinger was the German ambassador to Washington, so we go way back. And the pressure put on the Allies then was enormous. They were told that they were, you know, they were taking all kinds of, the Bush administration at the time was threatening all kinds of sanctions on European allies if they didn't go along. The Germans were, as you say, holding out. The French were holding out for a while. But the truth is that the United States manipulated the data at that time to really convince them that they were under threat. And eventually some came along, some didn't. The threats there were trade sanctions threatened again. I mean, that was where Freedom Fries came from. All of us are old enough to remember this stuff. But, you know, I think that there is a memory of that. And that if you get on the wrong side of the United States, you will suffer in places like NATO. And, you didn't hear anybody questioning the legality of it when in the press conferences with Mark Rutte or even with Trump. They were questioning at this point the sort of veracity of reports that say that the nuclear program was not completely obliterated, as the Trump administration is saying. But the legality was not something that was questioned there. And I'm sure that will disappoint a lot of our listeners. It seemed like people had already moved on from that yesterday in The Hague anyway.
This sense of the leverage, you know, this kind of galactic level leverage that the Americans have in terms of security over Europe. I mean, this is certainly not gone suddenly with this summit, right, Terry?
Exactly.
A lot of people are looking ahead to the global force posture review, which the Pentagon is conducting at the moment. We're expecting that in a few months. What's the chatter about that in The Hague? Because there are fears in Europe that that could involve the Americans then saying, all right, we're going to pull out a bunch of troops from Europe now.
It is expected to. We didn't talk about it a lot in The Hague, but the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Matt Whitaker, has said that after The Hague summit, we will start to discuss that. Of course, they are waiting on the posture review, which is due, I think, end of summer. We'll probably be late. But it is widely expected that the U.S. will now start to pull out troops from Europe. And there are varying reports at which level this will start to make the Europeans uncomfortable, because the U.S. surged some 20,000 troops at the beginning of Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine. If they just pull back those troops that were never expected to be here long-term, people won't start getting too nervous. They're interspersed along the front line. Everybody loves that they're here, but it would be understandable to pull them back as sort of a rapid reaction force, and now they've been here, you know, 3 years. It's when you start to pull back 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 more troops that Europe will be very uncomfortable and understand that this really puts them in a different security position because of the U.S. troops. But it's not only those people who are here on the ground in Europe. What people are really going to be looking for is what troops are assigned to be at the ready back in the United States as follow-on forces. Because under the new regional plans, which have been approved and which are now being implemented, which looks at the Russian threat and allocates NATO's resources where they would be needed in case of a threat, there are hundreds of thousands of troops back in the U.S. who would be supposed to be sent to Europe in case of an attack. Those are taken off of basically this assignment. Then Europeans, who the military planners, are going to start to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also about capabilities. At the moment, we keep asking the German government, also in background briefings all the time, are you getting any kind of signals out of the US that the Trump administration might want to review the pledge that the previous government gave Germany, which was the stationing of medium-range missiles by beginning 2026? For now, the German government is simply enjoying the silence on this. But this is an open question.
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European current affairs programme, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
Yeah. Okay, so Nina, so that's the picture. We've got this looming, you know, this possibility of troops being reassigned, even of plans about missiles being changed. What's Berlin's strategy going to be towards the US kind of navigating this period ahead? Is it going to continue to be this kind of keep them as close as possible, this kind of kowtow kind of mode?
It will have to be because, of course, yes, they've got an almost infinite amount of money now that they can spend on all these issues. But if the Americans were to withdraw some troops, or in any case, Germany's infrastructure needs fixing, right? Everybody will have to move through Germany at the heart of this continent. We don't have the roads. We don't have the bridges. They can't.
So, in a wartime scenario, you mean you actually need to move
absolutely
hardware through Germany,
or even just for training? I mean, if the Germans want to convince the Americans, okay, we've understood the message, then they need to show that they can't just, you know, cancel military training or whatever because they can't run their tanks across some bridge because it hasn't been fixed. I mean, that is not very credible, then, right? So, this is something where I think we're going to see the diggers rolling, as the vice chancellor here, Lars Klingbeil from the Social Democrats, keeps saying, by the end of the summer. That's at least what he's hoping. But of course, that is going to require a lot of time. So I think the Germans have understood that the Americans want clear commitments, but they don't just want the sweet words. They also want to see action on the ground. And this is something where I think we'll have a proper debate also here in Germany about, you know, where is the money going? Is it fair to spend so much on building new barracks? Because still, when it comes to Germany and the German defense situation, the key point that they need to fix is the lack of personnel. It doesn't matter how many tanks they buy, how many planes they have, theoretically, if they have no people who can fly those planes and drive those tanks. So, you know, we'll have a big debate about conscription later this summer. Yeah. Already, we'll have a new draft law in the cabinet, at least, about, you know, a voluntary form of military service. And Boris Pistorius wants a paragraph in there, so the German defense minister, to allow for a change to essentially mandatory conscription again. So if that becomes necessary, he says, you know, if we don't find enough volunteers, then we'll need to return to, you know, mandatory conscription.
Okay, so all in line with this sense of, yeah, fulfilling the demands of the Americans, but also acting in self-interest. But Michele, I mean, there are some issues.
Yes.
In fact, some pretty big ones where, of course, the Europeans and the Germans in particular are completely at odds with the US administration. There's the whole issue of tariffs. Merz would like the Americans to take a tougher line on Putin. There's also the kind of bubbling tensions over the AfD and how to deal with the far right, where the US administration has been critical. So if Berlin is trying to keep the Americans so happy, how do they deal with these bones of contention?
Well, you just gave a complete list of the issues that Friedrich Merz is on the record on pushing back against the Trump administration.
And how hard is he pushing back?
Well, he keeps saying, and this is the wording he seems to have discovered for himself, that he will keep trying to convince the US president that tariffs are not a good idea. Also that...
good luck with that, right?
More sanctions will... Well, actually, some argue that the US bond market is going to fix that one. So that's actually... a domestic issue for now. There he's relying on market forces to do the convincing work. And then there's the key issue of pushback against Russia. At the moment, that means a new package of sanctions. The Europeans are about to launch their 18th packet of sanctions in the US. We know in Congress it's very hotly debated whether there will be more US sanctions. For now, the US president is very much on the brakes on that one. And so this is going to be something that where Friedrich Merz tries to build his political brand on not simply mollycoddling the US president, instead being someone who tries to convince him and keeps this very conciliatory, friendly tone. Mm.
But can I add another bone of contention is that digital tax that some here in Berlin are talking about. You know, we've got the conservatives in power and they're saying, OK, we need to look at the power of the algorithms. And of course, many of the platforms that we all use, that also DW uses to broadcast our content, they're American run and they hardly pay any taxes. And now there are ideas to impose a 10% tax on that. So that could also become tricky.
Yeah.
I was just going to come in on that and this place where with Donald Trump, those two things could easily get with Trump. He doesn't see a difference. There's certainly no dividing line for him between talking about tariffs on his closest allies and talking about defense. You know, in fact, he brought it up yesterday himself, as Spain was the first country that came out and said it wasn't going to spend 5% of its GDP on defense. He talked in his press conference about how, well, we've got trade talks coming up with Spain. I'm going to charge them the same amount of money there.
But you can't do that, right? I mean, you know, all the trade issues are being discussed with the European Commission. So Spain is not going to negotiate trade with the U.S. unilaterally, bilaterally.
Spain cannot impose tariffs on the U.S., but it doesn't mean that the U.S. can't impose tariffs on Spain. Nobody knew what he was talking about, if he knew. But he did say we've got some trade talks coming up. And, you know, there are certain things they can discuss. They can't have an overarching trade policy. But he said he was going to make sure it costs Spain more money to not spend 5% on its GDP. But these are, you know, even if he can't do it, these are the kind of things that he will try to do. And I spent his whole first presidency Googling, can he do this? And I suspect.
Although, of course, he can select certain products, just like the tariffs that were imposed in response by the European Union, like the Harley Davidsons and the Bourbon targeted US states that are Republican. Of course, there can be a selection of products that
like Spanish ham
that hit the Spanish.
But Terry, maybe just a final question to you. So I mean, what we're talking about here, it's like it's kind of moving to a kind of a paradigm of a relationship that is very transactional, right? It's like, okay, I need you to do this, and if you don't do that, then I will punish you in that way. Or you can maybe make an arrangement with me on this in order to enable that. I mean, do you feel, Terry, that kind of Trump has kind of, I mean, he's sort of changed the paradigm of this relationship, which always used to be about values and we're all together, and it's become a Trumpian transatlantic world.
I cannot believe, and I say this speaking personally, how little pushback there is against that this time. In the first Trump administration, where I also covered NATO, covered the EU, you definitely saw people speaking out against it more, even if it was just in your personal conversations with officials or something like this. Now, I think when people look at what's happening in the United States, the real crackdown on any kind of dissent, people are afraid to speak out against him now, and that includes prime ministers and presidents of other countries. I don't think you're going to see a lot of vocal opposition. They're just going to hope that, you know, his attention span is so short that he moves on to something else before he remembers to do something bad to us. But at the moment, again, and this will be the last thing because I need to run, but this is why the tone yesterday at the NATO summit was so unexpected from Trump. He was actually a little emotional and you played that clip where he said, you know, I understand they love their country. They just want to protect them and they need our help. Nobody had ever seen Trump speak like this before, that it had dawned on him that really nobody is trying to rip off the United States. This is a partnership done out of genuine love for one's country and wanting to protect it. So we don't know how long this mood will last, right? It could have even disappeared on the plane on the way home. But this will be something that Europeans will cling to and hope they can build on. And all of the machinations that we saw Mark Rutte do that made people uncomfortable as they were happening will be chalked up as the best policy for achieving the outcome that we saw yesterday in The Hague. So there'll be some monument to Rutte out outside NATO headquarters as the real Trump whisperer, because you could not imagine the relief that people felt watching that press conference and seeing Trump say, I understand why they do what they do, and it's not a ripoff.
Thanks so much, Terry. And we've had 6 minutes and 17 seconds more of your time than we thought we'd get. So thank you so much.
Good to see you, Terry. And I just want to flag up that the contrast couldn't be greater to 2016, when Angela Merkel essentially, the first time she spoke into a camera after Donald Trump was elected the first time around, gave him a complete rundown of the conditionality of international law and human rights, which will be the basis for their cooperation.
I will work with him if.
Exactly. And now he has done something that for decades every US government has carefully avoided doing, which is bombing Iran.
Yeah.
So it's a completely new reality.
Okay, final thought. So we're talking about how Europe is kind of bending to Trump's will. But there's a paradox here, isn't there? Because this, if Europe does follow through with this, if Europe does invest this much in its own defense, then Europe will become potentially more independent, more able to stand on its own two feet, and more able to say no to a future Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. And that really is the irony. And I thought, this is interesting because Donald Trump praised, we all remember when Friedrich Merz visited him in Washington in the Oval Office, he praised Germany for investing a lot more in defense. And then he said, and I'm really happy with you, but, you know, don't go too far. I may have to stop it at some point. So he does know that as well, you know, that there is this risk that the Europeans have really understood it and that they are trying to work together more, because we didn't even talk in this episode about how the Europeans are now trying to make joint procurement easier, for example. There's a cooperation between Germany and Norway who are now going to buy weapons together. You know, they're building tanks, they're investing in drone manufacturing together. All these things are possibly also going to lead to a stronger Europe, which is funny. And just one last thought, because we're ending this episode soon, but you said, is this more transactional now? And I think we really have to be careful about wording, because some people would call it bullying. Some people would call it blackmailing.
Mm-hmm. Michaela, is it blackmailing, or is it you, like Trump the daddy, is needed to kind of get the children of Europe to grow up?
I wouldn't want to put it like that. The question is, who is Europe? Because under pressure, European leaders can suddenly decide things that simply weren't on the cards. And that includes finally finding some kind of agreement who produces what, not just thinking in the national interest, because suddenly there's an overarching mutual interest. And at the same time, we did a whole episode on this, whether the German public is ready to embrace a stronger military. Democratically elected leaders, rightfully so, live in constant fear of their voters. And it is a question of how far along that road of a necessity to bolster defense and spend more on defense, maybe not spend as much on social spending, because defense at this moment in time is more important, and then still get reelected. So here, Donald Trump, ironically, is really helping them in making that case and actually creating the less dependency that many European leaders have been talking about for decades, that it's a necessity. So there is an irony in this, that this very, you call it blackmail, others call it without alternative action, is something that can actually move the EU forward and bring them closer together, when really they were at risk of drifting apart even further and thinking even more in terms of their national interests.
Let's wrap it up. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching this episode of Berlin Briefing. If you're watching on YouTube, do leave us comments below. And if you'd rather listen as a podcast, do sign up on any podcast provider. We're out there on all of them. And of course, sign up for our weekly dw.com Berlin Briefing newsletter if you haven't done that already. That's a great rundown of what's going on here in Germany. But for now, from all of us here in Berlin and Terry, now fluttering off to do whatever's next in Terry's world, thank you very much.